why did you avoid the Kennedy assassination?
Oh, it was actually partly because of Robert Todd Lincoln, and there was just so much continuity between Lincoln, Garfield, and McKinley because they were all Republicans. And then you kind of watch the Republican Party progress in that era to be from the party of Lincoln to the Republican Party we all know and love today. And then that Robert Todd Lincoln lived to attend the last chapters on the Lincoln Memorial, which is kind of an expression of the McKinley-Theodore Roosevelt generation's version of Lincoln. So it had such a through line that it seemed like a complete story to me. And also, as you can tell from the title, the book is not entirely tactful, and I'm still, you know, a fairly nice girl, and when I was writing that, you know, President Kennedy's brother was still alive, his daughter is still alive, that there's just so much active mourning still happening, and people were kind of over Garfield's death by 2005, you know, and it gave me a little more freedom and a little more distance, I think.
Okay. We're going to turn the house lights up and let people ask some questions. I guess we could turn
I will add, though, as my publisher put it, so you've given me a book to sell that is about every assassination except the one people care about.
Yes. Okay. Anybody out there with a question?
I'll try to kick it off.
Okay.
Hi.
I actually just read your book on Lafayette, and I was very taken by your discussion of the Battle of Brandywine and the memorial that's currently in place where he was wounded. So I got to thinking, as you can tell by my accent, I'm a Yankee, transplanted here like many in North Carolina. If you'd share your perspective on the current debate going on about various memorials to Civil War, secessionist, all of that debate that's going on with what to do with these memorials or how to reinterpret them or to get rid of them.
Right. I mean, I think statues, that's a more complicated question. Confederate flags, no, we're done with those. Get rid of them, especially on government property. Especially on United States government property, the flying of a treasonous secessionist flag is offensive to the United States of America. So that is, there's just like, that's not complicated at all. As for the plaques and statues, it's a little more complicated because, I mean, they're not just monuments to those people. They're a record of their time, you know. So, like, maybe it's better if there's a way. I don't know that they should just be left there to embarrass the townspeople. But if there can be some kind of context or, you know, way through plaques or texts or I don't know, Richard Serra builds a wall around them, or I don't know if there's a way that they to talk about what people used to believe and who they used to care about. I mean, it is sort of interesting to me as, you know, someone who writes about historic markers and plaques and statues and stuff, how they are records of the dead, and they come to mean something else, you know, like there's this one statue I think I write about in the assassination book of Roscoe Conkling, who was the biggest deal population, the biggest deal politician in the state of New York in the late 19th century. And he has a statue of himself. I just walked by it yesterday in Madison Square Park, and it just says his name, Roscoe Conkling, because everybody knows who Roscoe Conkling is. He's the most powerful man in New York. He's the one who made Theodore Roosevelt vice president so he could get him out of his hair. You know, so there's something that is so perfectly symbolizes Conkling and his own egomania and his power at the time, that like across that park, Chester Arthur, who was president, became president after Garfield was assassinated. It actually says he was president, you know, because he seemed like such an inconsequential person. They have to say on there, president. And this other guy, he was just such a big deal. It was just like no one ever thought, oh, we should say who he was or what he did, because he was just so famous. It would be like if we put up a statue of Beyonce, would we like put anything under there? We wouldn't have to, but maybe people in the future are like, wow, they were really into this Beyonce lady. They just assumed we would know of her accomplishments. So I don't really have an answer for you, but I don't know that erasure is always the way to go, but
Well, you're from Oklahoma.
Would you call that the South? Well, I was born in eastern Oklahoma, and there's a certain, like, the part, you know, very close to Arkansas, right. And I think those people consider themselves Southerners. I think the rest of the country thinks of them as the Midwest.
Okay.
Certainly, during the Civil War, it was Indian Territory, and the Cherokee mostly sided with the Confederacy, and my own great-great-grandfather fought in the Confederate Army. I don't remember know what your point was. I'm not saying this as a person who comes from a completely, you know, gilded history.
Right.
There are people. I come from people.
You're kidding.
No.
Who knew?
Yeah.
Let's go over here.
Yes, I was glad to hear you say you can consider yourself, at least in your books, more as a journalist. I spent 30 years as a newspaper reporter, and that's why I love your books so much.
Rest in peace, brother.
Well, that's why I love your books so much. I read them more like as a journalist.
Thank you.
What I love about, one thing I really like about your books are the little nuggets you put in there in the Lafayette book about the apron from Lafayette's wife that George Washington wore, or the conversations you had at the bed and breakfast and assassination vacation, or the trip down to Orlando for that little cemetery where the piece of skull was buried.
Yeah, fun road trip.
When you're in your process, or the boxes, the box lunches and unfamiliar fishes, that was just fascinating.
Oh, yeah, the plate lunch, yeah.
Yeah. In your process of writing or investigating for your books, you're saying, okay, this is what I'm going to use as a little nugget in there, or
some artifacts or tidbits or just lore jump out at me. Some are more symbolic than others, you know. And the plate lunch is a great example with the history of Hawaii, because those of you who have been to Hawaii and have the plate lunch, it's the traditional mixed plate lunch in the islands, and it's always a scoop or two of Japanese style rice. Protein, usually like Asian, Japanese, or Hawaiian, like mahi-mahi or teriyaki chicken or something, and then a scoop of macaroni salad. And and it, like, the first time I went there, I was like, wow, there's got to be a story here, you know? And there is. And to me, it's the story of the New England missionary. It's the story of what the book was about, which was the New England missionaries coming to Hawaii and their children and grandchildren overthrowing the Queen of Hawaii and giving the islands to the United States so that it becomes basically a big military base for the United States. And you can, that's just, and then those same missionary descendants started the sugar plantations, which meant that all of these other workers from all over the world had to be brought in to work the sugar plantations, and especially workers from Portugal, Japan, Korea, and how the sugar plantation workers would share food. So there's like the whole story of the last 200 years of those islands is in that styrofoam plate of macaroni salad, you know. So like some objects just jump out at me as almost being like little microcosms of the story itself.
So when you finish a day of touring, do you take notes on that so that when you sit down to actually write the book, you'll remember what you thought?
Oh, yeah, of course. So I take very voluminous notes, and then when I'm ready to start writing, when I'm finished researching, which usually I'm never finished researching, it's just here comes the deadline, because I make a living as a writer and have to finish those books to be able to buy macaroni salad. I have all of that stuff. I have each thing on an index card. So an historical fact I need to convey, a quote from one of my characters, some dumb joke I've thought of, just a shenanigan, some, in portrait of a person, an historical figure, anything. Each one of those gets its own card, and then I sit on my living room rug moving the cards around. So how I structure them.
You write in longhand, or do you sit at
a
computer?
No, I use a computer.
Okay, just checking. Because there's a thing called OneNote you could save your notes in.
Evernote. But there's something about holding the cards and like moving them around with my hands. I know that's very 20th century.
No, I like it. I like it. There's hope yet for me. Where are we here? Over here? Okay.
Hi. Hi, I'm Sarah.
Hi.
Hi.
My question's about Lafayette. And your book came out just as Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton was coming out. And
the Knightley Hamilton question.
The Knightley Hamilton question. And I'm just curious. Do I win an award for this one? Just curious in seeing your interpretation of Lafayette becoming kind of a tween pop star in Hamilton. You know, there's these 15-year-olds that are suddenly in love with the character. And if you have anything to kind of speak to seeing a character well researched kind of become the simplistic kind of one-note character we see in Hamilton, if you've seen any adjustments in how people react to it.
I mean, is he simplistic and one-note in Hamilton?
A little bit.
He has better hair than historical Lafayette, and he is, that character has so much joie de vivre, but so did historical Lafayette, and that character is very brave on the battlefield, just like historical Lafayette. I guess they do kind of gloss over him being a deadbeat dad, I love that portrayal of Lafayette in Hamilton. More importantly, Lafayette would have loved Lafayette in Hamilton, you know, because he was such a glory whore. But I've had the experience. I mean, now that you've mentioned 1776 and assassins, so I've had this. That would have been the third time that I've seen, some of my people become song and dance men. It's kind of like with the tour guide. I mean, you can always learn something watching or looking at a representation of something. Maybe it comes from my art history background. The Lafayette in Hamilton just has so much of his charisma, and that was part of his charm. And I mean, I wouldn't have cared about him if he was just all about, you know, charm and charisma, but I mean, he was a glory whore, but like one incredibly positive practical after effect and result of that was, because he wanted glory, he fought really hard, and he was a very hard worker, and at every point in the war, all he wanted to do was, you know, to Washington, he was always like, put me in, coach. And he was relentless. You know, he got wounded at the Battle of Brandywine, and before he was finished recuperating, he just wrapped his bum leg in a blanket and rode back to the front because he just wanted to get back to work. So, and you know, throughout the war, Washington is losing his troops in droves, they're deserting, and here's this one French kid, this very charismatic French kid who, you know, he walks the walk, and I think that part of seeing Lafayette and seeing Lafayette rap is pretty charming. Yeah. I think that I could have used more Lafayette and maybe less Hamilton in Hamilton, but I guess that's what you get when you go to Hamilton. You get a lot of Hamilton.
And all three of those musicals are fairly historically accurate. They did a lot of research to get the history part of it fairly.
Yeah.
Accurate.
I mean, one thing when I was watching 1776 at Ford Theater that I hadn't really thought about when I was buying the ticket was when you're watching the part of the story when the Founding Fathers are having the debate about slavery, like, do we care about this enough to fall apart before we get together? And they're having this debate, and, you know, Adams says the posterity will never forgive us for this. And to, like, look at the stage where they're having that discussion, and you can see where it's going. And it's going, it's the bullet pointing into the back of Lincoln's head. You know, they're putting off this thing that Lincoln is going to have to deal with and die for. And it was very educational moment just seeing that all come together, because see, especially seeing it in that room where you can see like who's going to be one of the people who pay for this procrastination, and it was Lincoln. Mostly it was generations of slaves, but it was also Lincoln.
Over here.
It's my understanding that when Washington was elected, it wasn't enough to be a white male to be allowed to vote. You actually had to have a certain amount of wealth or property.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you have any idea?
You have a problem with that?
I'm sorry? I couldn't hear you.
Do you have a problem with that?
It's like you're saying
that they weren't perfect and they made some mistakes and they were a little bit uppity. Go on.
Well, my question is, how uppity were they? What percentage of the white males were permitted to vote?
I don't know. Does anyone know that? I don't know what the percentage is.
Do you have any idea what the rules were? Was it just real estate or gold or slaves?
I think it was property, like, you know, of the real estate variety, I'm pretty sure. Even the people who owned people usually owned the land where those people lived. So, yeah, it was physical property, land, buildings.
Any idea how long that lasted?
I really don't know. Does anyone know? You know?
So could be a Jeopardy question, Nick.
I'm a high school history teacher, and we're learning about this, like, last week and this week. So to start with, it's on a state-by-state basis.
That makes
states,
sense. Mm-hmm.
And this is constitutional, but states determine, like, voter, voter requirements.
Yeah.
It's still an issue. But
like how all the, like, women could vote in the western states way before the rest of the country.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So basically, by the election of 1800, which Jefferson won just by a nose hair, that was beginning to turn. So there was already beginning to be, and that was one of the big rifts between the Democratic Republicans and the Federalists. So, like, as more and more people got voting rights at a lower threshold of property ownership, that tipped things in the direction of the Jeffersonians kind of taking power in the election of 1800, just barely, and that was more kind of luck than it was like having enough votes. But then by the age of Jackson, by the late 1820s, virtually all white men pretty much had the vote. And so by that point, like, you know, relatively new immigrants become a major voting constituency and that kind of thing. And that's the big reason why Jackson was successful when he was.
That makes sense. Thank you, Teach.
So when it became, hold on, when it became possible, when Jefferson's party gained popularity because more people could vote, did the other side try to put in voter ID?
Yeah, they did, actually. That's exactly what they did. Okay. But they did so a little, like, they kind of jumped the gun with that. So basically what happened, this is the Alien Sedition Acts, the sort of ill-fated Alien Sedition Acts. So John Adams, Daddy Adams, as we call him, John Q's
Please
father.
Please don't call him that. No.
Juicy
the
Q's
elder.
Father. We call him Juicy Q. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Adams.
I want you to be my history teacher.
Adams foolishly doesn't veto his party's, like, these four Alien and Sedition Acts, which were, you know, at best, kind of like blocks against French radicalism. The French Revolution is going on at this time, radical phase, kind of rounding out. But at very worst, like unconstitutional ways to keep their own party in power. And
luckily, we're done with that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. One of these is still kind of on the books. The Enemies Act is the reason why we had Japanese internment in World War II. So the first three, or like three of the four Alien Sedition Acts went away. Then you got the Enemies Act, which is still like quasi as law, if we need it, which says that we can detain people who are born in a country that we're at war with. So anyhow.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thanks.
So, yeah. You know what, like all of that you wouldn't just give the like easy answer. You wanted to like go through all of the complicated stuff. That's the flip side of nonfiction. Sometimes you get like, oh, Lincoln's son was there for all three assassinations. And then sometimes you have to explain all these like really complicated details too. So it's the other side of nonfiction, which is you have to deal with reality.
Yeah, and that's what I have to do about every day, like between the hours of 8 a.m. and 2:50.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and kids love reality.
Yeah. So the voters, evidently.
Yeah.
Go ahead, ma'am.
Actually, I'm a high school civics teacher, so I'll second everything.
Oh, they still exist.
And it's been a really interesting year, so I get a lot of questions about why is this happening? Is this normal when Donald Trump opens his mouth? And I'm like, oh, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. One of the questions I have, and I've read all of your stuff, including Take the Cannoli, which I love that book beyond measure, and it gets stolen from my class usually about every 2 years, so I replace it. The question I have is that you largely concentrate on our founding fathers. Have you thought about potentially moving over into, especially with this year and the potential in the White House, of going with the history, you know, women's suffrage or something along that line where you're focusing on history of women and in the political movement in the United States?
Oh, uh-huh. I mean, I write about public life, so that has, you know, mostly in the history of this country, that is dudes. I write a little bit about the suffragists actually in the Lafayette book because the whole end of it is about Lafayette Park as a place for protest, and that starts with the National Woman's Party, and it was the suffragists who established that park as a place for protest, and it was them just camped out there for years getting on President Wilson's nerves. And I did write one op-ed for the Times about Hillary being a girl this summer. I don't know. I mean, and I mentioned, you know, in that piece how coming from Montana and, you know, the home of Jeanette Rankin and stuff, and how that always affected how I saw politics, and I write about what it was like for me as a 14-year-old when Geraldine Ferraro became the Democratic vice presidential candidate, and you know, being so excited about that and cutting her photo out of the newspaper the next morning, and how I didn't really think I cared about Hillary Clinton's gender all that much. I was going to vote for her because she had been my senator in New York, and I thought she did a pretty good job, and she was very hardworking, and just, I was going to vote for her for really boring reasons, which is the reason this is how you should vote for people. Voting is supposed to be boring. It's supposed to be reasoned and, you know, dull, and that's all I thought about her. I just thought of her as such a hardworking person and who does her homework, and then watching the convention, that one night of the convention when they had the montage of all the presidents and they were all male, I just started weeping. I went through two boxes of Kleenex and I realized, I guess I do care about this a lot, and maybe feeling represented is important in a representative democracy. So would I ever, I mean, there are quite a number of existing good books on those subjects. I mean, it is interesting to me about, like, going back to what Teach said before about the voting being in the states, and it is interesting to me how women had the right to vote in the Western states. for, you know, quite a bit longer than the rest of the country. And I think part of that was just that life in the western states was just so hellish and hard, and the women had to have hellish and hard lives too. And part of them having more power just came from the equality of their lives. So that is interesting to me, and Jeanette is always interesting to me. There's a statue of her in my hometown across from the post office, and she's a very fascinating person who, you know, she's the first woman elected to Congress, and she was elected to Congress before women had the right to vote nationally, and became, as she put it, the first woman who ever voted to give women the right to vote. So yeah, obviously it stirs me up, you know, and all the, like, Susan B. Anthony, Alice Paul stuff. And, you know, there's even I think I mentioned it in the Lafayette book of Susan B. Anthony storming the centennial celebration at Independence Hall. Like, she was a real party pooper, you know, like showing up saying, like, you know, we want these, all this stuff you're celebrating, well, we want it too. So, yeah, obviously it appeals to me and it's interesting. I haven't, I don't know, though. It's hard for me to write it. It's hard for me to commit to writing a book about something I'm super excited about. Something that, you know, there are those people who write those books and you see them promoting their books on TV and it's like, I love my guy. I can never write one of those books, you know, because I always see my people as people the way I see myself, as a person with failings and, you know, someone who said unfortunate things to her mother, and someone, you know, I'm not very good at hero worship in general. And the idea of just writing a book about people I admire, would I do that? I don't know. Maybe. There has to be some bad stuff too. Oh, he's referring to my father's canon. Where is the canon? It's with its brothers. There have been several more canons my father has constructed from scratch since I did that piece about his canon nearly 20 years ago. I think there are maybe, I want to say, 7 or 8 canons now. 4th of July at his house is a real dog frightener. he keeps making them. My father is retired now, so his art projects have, you know, spiraled out of control. Cannons, blacksmithery. There was a period where he decided he needed to learn how to make buggy wheels. Doesn't have a buggy or a horse. Just needed to know how to, just like, I need to know how to make a buggy wheel. Made a buggy wheel. He's still tinkering, my father.
I'm being told we have time for one more question because there are books to be signed, and I think she has to go to a reception or something. So let's take the final question. You have the final question.
Hi. Hey. Hope it's good. Like, what your question sort of like puts a cap on the whole evening, and everyone will go home thinking about.
All right. Well, coming in here, I had no idea that you played Violet in The Incredibles.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, whoa. And my friend kept like saying, like, Violet, Violet, Violet. And I was like, why does she keep saying that? So do you have any information on Incredibles 2? It's been like... it's been like...
No, I do not. I do not have any information on that. But I will say that... As someone who, you know, slaves away writing books, it has been interesting in my career to have been part of one thing that people care about, you know? Like, everyone sees it, everyone loves it. I'm very proud to have been part of that. But it has put the whole book writing thing in a little bit of perspective, I have to say. And for whatever reason, people care about... animated masterpieces more than narrative nonfiction. I don't personally get it, but I can tell you it's a fact.
Isn't that what this whole election's about?
Yeah. It's just a represent. Yeah, that's what the election is, a referendum on that.
Oh. And with that, I want to thank Sarah Vell.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.